Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program about the economic crisis. We want to welcome our audience here this evening and invite you to visit us often on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Often referred to by media as the Renaissance Man, Patrick Yam is CEO of Sensei Partners LLC, an early-stage Menlo Park-based venture capital firm. His 25-plus year career includes responsibilities as a macroeconomist, financial and technology executive, and an institutional investor with significant experience in company building, investment banking, investment management, and venture capital. He has been associated with the Federal Reserve Bank, Lehman Brothers, Citicorp Investment Bank, and Matthews International Management. A published author, he teaches and lectures on entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University's Levy School, where he is the Dean's Executive Professor of Entrepreneurship and a former faculty member of the Venture Capital Institute. He is also associated with UC Santa Barbara, where he is a member of the Investment Committee, as well as a Senior Director of the Economic Forecast Project. Please join me in welcoming Patrick Yam.
Guess what? The next hour is going to go by really quickly. We're going to have a lot of photos. And Tom, that was really nice of you. Thank you for the introduction. Most certainly, we should give a round of applause to Tom, Gloria Duffy, their associate. Fine job they provide in managing and providing to us this public forum known as the Commonwealth Club. No need to introduce myself. Tom did a great job. Most certainly, I've given this speech in many cities. I often address the duress, the economic duress, the financial duress that we've endured past 18 months. I've spoken to this from audiences from New Orleans to San Francisco. What an opportunity, and I thank you for this, in a sense that for the next hour, we'll go through a period whereupon I'll provide you with numerous slides and ask you for your attention. And as Tom mentioned, subsequent to this, we'll have a period for questions.
How many of you are exhausted from all the economic changes that we've endured this past 18 months, especially from the financial sector? These times remind me of the song, Living on the Fault Line, by the legendary rock group, the Doobie Brothers. It's ever so precarious, yet it's so dynamic. Well, certainly the first quarter of 2009 has disturbingly eclipsed the troubling days of 2008. 2008 seemed to last an eternity. Definitely, it was a non-epic year challenged by various economic and financial sector problems and societal disruptions. Today, we're fighting an 8-alarm global economic fire when we've only known the dimensions of much smaller challenges. We do not have the luxury of time in combating our global economic challenges. We have a near insurmountable mission of not only correcting our economy, but building a sustainable economic platform for the 21st century and beyond. Precariously, many varied economic challenges lie ahead. Today, we live in times in which we are best informed, and transparency is a moment-to-moment update of issues. And yet, we are often less informed and ever more confused. We gather information from various mediums, often snippets from the internet, paper, television, provide alternative and conflicting views that challenge our understanding of today's global economic malaise. How did the economic recession begin? When? What is the impact? What is tomorrow going to be for our children and heirs? These questions and many others are often asked and unanswered. Tonight, I'll share with you some considerations as we travel the Odyssey to Optimism. As a concerned citizen, I am presenting these considerations from a nonpartisan viewpoint. I am not Jim Cramer of CNBC, but I am as passionate about the economic future of our country and able to share through my experience and knowledge this macro overview of our troubled economy to hopefully incite each and every one of you to seek a solution. I've benefited from commencing my career at the Federal Reserve Bank, which provided me a unique global view of our current economic challenges. As a financier, investor, company builder, and published academician, I unequivocally say that I've never experienced a period as difficult as today's economic times. Unstable markets or challenges to our society. This economic catharsis impacts all facets of our economy, society, and citizenry. As President Obama stated in his acceptance speech on his election night, we cannot have a thriving Wall Street while Main Street suffers. In this country, we rise or fall as one nation, as one people. In July 2002, before a Senate Commerce Committee, John Laguerre, the CEO of Global Crossing, offered a poignant quote, which surely could represent the challenges facing our current economy and financial markets. Long before Laguerre's representation, a noted Greek philosopher, Plutarch, stated, "To make no mistakes is not in the power of man, but from their errors and mistakes, the wise and good learn wisdom for the future." Throughout my career, we've experienced various economic downturns, early 1970s, 74-75, early 1980s, 1987, early 1990s, 1997, the dot-com bubble from 2001 to 2003, and today. Today's economic retrenchment with distinct idiosyncrasies is troubling to our domestic as well as global economies and has the potential to be significantly worse than its predecessors. Referring to Plutarch's quote, "Those who do not learn from past mistakes are subject to again suffer its consequences," I contend that we haven't learned from our past. Today's economic downturn emanated from the dot-com bubble, and we haven't learned from the mistakes of the dot-com bubble. In both instances, excess liquidity accentuated the use of excessive leverage and falsely encouraged many professionals to be benign to applying proper risk management. Similarities abound among both periods. A principal parallel is that liquidity and the excessive use of leverage has encouraged the undue taking of risk, undefined and uncontrolled, that jeopardize our domestic economy and that of the world. My academic research and publications on the modern evolution of the capital markets, and that specifically the venture capital sector, showed that excess liquidity incited the evolution of the venture capital industry. The evolution was impactful and influenced both entrepreneurs, investors, as it transformed the venture capital industry from a cottage industry to beyond. The absorption of excess liquidity was slow and painful and adversarial to our economy. The ills of the dot-com era became a precursor to today's distressed economy. I spent considerable time researching, teaching, and addressing the adversarial impact of the dot-com excesses. I noted that the impact of the evolution in the venture capital industry, and in general the capital markets, created a liquidity bubble, which eventually triggered a systemic financial risk to our economy. The risk also created considerable harm to global economies. The dot-com bubble was caused by excess liquidity raised between 1996 and the year 2000, which exceeded in aggregate all venture capital raised by institutional investors for and in investing in venture capital since the mid-1950s. The magnification of liquidity, compounded by the use of leverage or debt, exacerbated the downturn. In best economic times, the management of leverage is a skillful act and art. But in a challenging economic environment, ever more so. The magnitude of venture capital raised transformed not only the venture capital sector, but our economy. The changes would be profound for entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, as well as for our economy. I detailed my research in a book I collaborated in authoring, Raising Capital for Technology Companies. Come on in. There's a seat right up here. Due to excessive liquidity and heightened use of leverage in both periods, our economy was placed in a precarious position. Our economy undergoes a life cycle that transcends from stability to caution. Today, we're at a point well beyond caution. The digestion of excess liquidity from the dot-com period began in 2001 and continued to the beginning of our current crisis in late 2006. During this period, we experienced stable economic growth with sustained low interest rates. Economic growth was realized globally. Our gross domestic product exceeded $14 trillion by year-end 2008. The strong economy was fueled by the Federal Reserve's monetary policy of maintaining a strong dollar monetary policy. We adopted a weak dollar to assist in was fueled by the Federal Reserve's monetary policy of maintaining low interest rates, as well as by the fervent appetite of foreign investors to buy U.S. Treasuries. Contrary to our stated goal of maintaining a strong dollar monetary policy, we adopted a weak dollar to assist in the exporting of our goods and services, a monetary policy that remains questionable. As we maintain a weak dollar policy, our leading foreign export partners continue their voracious appetite to invest in U.S. Treasuries to ensure the competitiveness of their goods and services that were sold in the U.S. Today, foreign investors own in excess of 60% of U.S. Treasuries. With a domestic population that account for 5% of Earth's inhabitants, our consumers maintain a voracious retail appetite that contribute to a representation of between 20 and 25% of the world GDP. Our conspicuous consumption accounted for approximately 70% of our GDP in 2008 and caused a negative national savings rate of negative 2%. Similar to Japan, China became a prominent investor in our treasury bills and a significant influential force in our economic future. As foreign investors invested in U.S. treasuries, the cost of borrowing for our government dramatically decreased, which further accommodated our ability to expand our economy. Our nation's preference for debt increased dramatically. By year-end 2008, total debt as a percentage of GDP was nearly 350%, a level that exceeded by 40% that of total debt to GDP during the Great Depression. With fervent demand for our treasury bills of all duration, corresponding yields fell to near historic lows, benefiting various industries seeking financing from the capital markets, including our real estate industry. As corporate America and our fellow citizens became enamored with leverage, greater liquidity was injected into our economy. The government benefited from the low cost of borrowing as this fueled and supported our engagement in the second Middle East incursion and war. Conversely, the cost of mortgage financing became cheaper, and the individual goal of home ownership became ever more possible. In 1995, the percentage of home ownership was approximately 65%, near historical average. And due to a lower Treasury yield curve, expanded to nearly 70% by 2006, sliding back today to 68%, accounting for approximately 75.5 million homes owned. In part, Wall Street fueled the current growth of the real estate industry with its ability to package, securitize, and sell mortgage-backed securities. Financial engineers, namely investment bankers, were enamored with the various investment securities that could be stripped from a mortgage-backed security. Assisting investment bankers were their sales and trading desks that found the demand for MBS, mortgage-backed securities, quite acute due to their attractive liquidity and higher yields. MBSs attracted investors from the global asset management industry, especially hedge funds, which substituted them as short-term investment assets. The skill of Wall Street to securitize MBSs became such an art that the percentage of conventional mortgage loans decreased by over 50% by 2006, replaced by various forms of subprime and other exotic mortgage structures. As housing became more affordable, the acquisition of residential ownership became more prolific, consequently creating a bubble in the real estate industry. As more investors bought homes, the greater the acceleration of appreciation in the residential real estate markets. With appreciation and greater equity buildup in homes, many homeowners adopted the practice of extracting equity from their residences, the new ATM. Nearly $2 trillion was extracted and applied to various consumer purchases, and we became ever more a consumptive society and economy. As a keynote speaker at the Grubb-Nellis Economic Summit in September 2006, I discussed this unsustainable trend, which by then had grown by 250% from the early 1990s. Clearly, MBSs and the ability to acquire residential housing became the catalyst to our economic malaise and a factor that needs to be corrected for us to resolve our current economic problems. The attractive liquidity of MBSs and their higher investment yields, greater than most liquid investment instruments of a similar duration, attracted a growing hedge fund sector, and in general, the asset management industry. As the residential mortgage industry grew from the end of the dot-com bubble in 2003, to December 2007, our stock market benefited due to the newfound liquidity extracted from the residential sector. The robust stock market was exemplified by the large number of initial offerings, public offerings, which persisted until the beginning of 2008. The paucity of IPOs of venture-backed technology enterprises in the first half of 2008, namely three, truly was a great awakening to our current financial and economic crisis. With robust public investment in real estate markets, investors found a new confidence to adopt greater use of leverage. We became ever more a highly levered nation. According to the World Bank, our national debt grew astronomically to $13 trillion by year end 2008, roughly 84% of our GDP. With a strong real estate industry, healthy stock market, and increasing liquidity in our economy, our financial institutions further adopted a greater preference for leverage. The use of leverage proliferated and prudent risk management was abandoned as investors increasingly became allured by the benefits of possibly attaining greater absolute investment returns. Commensurate with the greater use of leverage by investors and financial institutions was their abandonment of practicing prudent risk management. The practice of hedging potential risk through credit derivatives, an unregulated investment market which today exceeds $62 trillion, became prolific. Increasingly, we continue to become a levered nation. Notably, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were levered 240 times, and several investment banks were levered in excess of 40 times. With heightened leverage and a slowing economy, we became an ideal candidate to confront a perfect financial and economic storm. The perfect storm became elevated due to the inattentiveness and lack of supervision by those entrusted with such responsibilities for the regulation of our financial sector. The overuse of leverage, benign neglect of prudent risk management practice, and a sleepy regulatory environment to govern our financial sector, our nation, and global economies were quickly brought to the brink, heightening our probability to trigger a systemic risk in the financial sector, which imperiled the health of our domestic as well as global economies. Throughout 2008, the brink became more apparent, and its acknowledgement by investors elevated fear and apprehension. A growing populace became concerned as to whether we may be confronting an economic downturn to that of the 1929 Great Depression. I wouldn't necessarily draw such quick parallels. Today, the maturity of our financial system is significantly more developed and resilient than that during the Great Depression. Nonetheless, the new 2008 economic domino theory has claimed among its notable casualties Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, and Lehman Brothers. In early September 2008, the brink triggered and we faced exuberant apprehension, which instilled a new heightened level of fear. So apprehension, mistrust, and we all became enveloped with a crisis of confidence. John Maynard Keynes, noted economist and writer, said, "The market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent." The exuberant apprehension has increased measured risk levels to new plateaus. The dot VIX index, a measure of stock market volatility, exceeded 80 in October, 4.5 times its historical average, and the TED spread, a measure reflecting cost of borrowing money among banks in the overnight interbank markets, exceeded 458 basis points, exceeding 3 times its average. These factors made it ever more limiting and costly for financial institutions to borrow short-term in the interbank markets, for corporate America to fund operational needs, and consumers to access any credit. Now, the stock market had transcended the brink. The impact brought our country beyond a crisis of confidence, and the financial pains were immeasurably felt by all citizens. The S&P 500 fell to a depth unseen since 1996. Consequently, investors sought safe harbor in their treasury markets, and yields precipitously fell nearly 2%. Mutual funds were dramatically impacted and suffered losses along with significant redemptions. The crisis of confidence accelerated and quickly. Retail investors redeemed mutual funds by an amount of $461 billion and increased savings by a like amount of nearly $472 billion. Corporate America became exposed and impacted. Numerous enterprises expediently decreased capital expenditures, especially for durable goods and investments in equipment and software. As a result, the crisis of confidence, heightened by fear and apprehension, drove the consumer to decrease consumer expenditures by 5%, a startling move, causing a decrease in fourth quarter GDP, 2008 GDP, of negative 6.2% annualized. The inflicted pains were notably reflected by severe losses in the financial and real estate markets, and home values fell below 50% for the first time in recorded history. Unemployment grew as nearly 5% of our workforce remained unemployed for greater than 27 weeks. The economic crisis definitely had transitioned from being on the brink to beyond. Historically, in such periods of chaos and heightened inefficient investment markets, ill-found practices become more discernible and not differently. Our current economic crisis has its own misdeeds and rogues list. Madoff, Israel, Merkin, and others. This crisis has exacted significant suffering on Wall Street as well as on Main Street. Many ascribe blame on Wall Street for our current economic crisis. Although Wall Street is accountable, in part, for this economic crisis, I ascribe the blame beyond the street. The economic crisis of 2008 has definitely changed the street. As a consequence, this economic crisis will have a new Wall Street, capital markets, and a new financial system. In fact, it could be said that with the convergence of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, the bank holding company charter, and regulation by the Federal Reserve, Wall Street has already entered a new era. Bulge bracket investment banks have been replaced by smaller independent investment boutiques, similar to Wall Street when I joined Lehman Brothers in the mid-1970s. Wall Street has not met its sunset, but is undergoing an evolution of the industry. In retrospect, the sea change of Wall Street entailed elimination of bulge bracket independent investment banks. Capital markets have been confused. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac became wholly owned federal government agencies. Residential real estate market in disarray. Contraction of financial institutions, failing and or acquired. Mounting loan losses and erosion of capital, limit lending. Interbank lending freeze, mistrust and uncertainty abounds. Short-term lending limited. Credit rating agencies summarily discredited. Securitization market evaporates. And interbank lending battered by apprehension, fear, and mistrust. Short-term credit among financial institutions become ever so limited. Similarly, Main Street and our nation's most valued asset, its citizens, have been severely impacted by this crisis. Either as individual citizens or as employees of corporate America, all have been harmed. This economic crisis was brought on by the confluence of several factors which have adversely impacted Main Street beyond the investment markets. These factors include the continued transformation of our country from a manufacturing base to service industry. We're experiencing a modern industrial revolution. Not only is the future of the financial sector severely challenged, but the automobile, airline, as well as other industries are evolving. Inevitably, in the new order, you need to be greater focus and niche to provide value. The economic crisis of 2008 has exacerbated this industrial revolution and inextricably cause severe damage, including consumer impacted by credit tightening, retail sector suffers. Domestic industrial growth slows severely. Global economies suffer concurrently. Industrial Revolution of 2008, as I mentioned, the financial, automobile, airline sectors are all evolving, along with others. Pensions have ever become more fragile, and the aging populace harmed. Unemployment increases. Foreclosures accelerate. Housing values diminish. Complicates financial bailout. State and local governments hampered by decrease in tax revenues. Ever more so, you read about it in the paper daily. Public services limited. And undoubtedly, higher taxes, they will come in the intermediate term. During such chaotic periods, when the economy and investment markets are unpredictable, I've shared with my graduate MBA students, leadership develops confidence. Confidence instills optimism. Optimism supports economic and investment market stability. The Federal Reserve, responsible for the economic guidance and governance of our country through monetary policy, immediately assessed and executed monetary remedies to quell the tsunami of economic distress. Together with Treasury, they quickly injected massive liquidity into our economy. In October 2008, TARP, a $700 billion relief program, was enacted to purchase distressed assets from our financial sector to stay systemic risk from our financial markets. Since its establishment in October 2008, TARP has been modified to include non-financial enterprises. Integral to restoring our financial markets is a restoration of a secondary market to securitize and facilitate the purchase of financial assets. In March 2009, the Federal Reserve enacted TALF, a nearly $1 billion program to catalyze the securitization markets and enable the credit markets to stabilize and preserve our economy from failing further into this abyss. TARP and TALF are early fiscal measures enacted to stabilize our economy. The infusion of massive liquidity provides short-term optimism, and yet many unanswered long-term questions remain. The recognition by the Federal Reserve and Treasury that we are enduring a magnitude of economic disturbance far beyond that experience in modern economic history is commendable. The necessity for the utilization of all monetary and fiscal measures is critical. Although we have committed significant sums, only a much smaller fraction has been used. The magnitude of this crisis is ominous, and as reflected in the amount of capital committed to date by the Federal Reserve of $12.8 trillion and $2.7 trillion by the Treasury. Notable is that we have spent a fraction of these commitments, $4 billion of a $900 billion TALF appropriation and $600 billion of the $700 billion TARP funds. And since the beginning of 2009, we've increased our money supply by a third. Liquidity abounds. Today's economic catharsis, a global pandemic, must be corrected by all responsible nations. Leading global economies have committed significant sums to urgently resolve their economic problems. China has committed nearly 14% of its GDP. Similarly, Japan, 4.5% of its GDP, the UK, 1.3%, and the European Union, 1.4%. The fiscal stimulus has assisted in quelling our crisis of confidence. Optimism has emerged since the beginning of March. The severe levels of fear and apprehension evident in the public investment markets have contracted. The Dodd-VIX index, a metric measuring investor sentiment, which in September 2008 experienced a volatile milestone of 4.5 standard deviation, recently decreased to less than one time. The contraction of the Dodd VIX index is important, as the stock market has often been a good prognosticator of our economy 6 to 9 months forward. Similarly, restoration of confidence among the financial sector is evident. The TED spread, the difference between a 3-month Treasury bill and a 3-month LIBOR, reflect a contraction in borrowing spreads among banks. A contraction in the TED spread is important, as a rising TED spread often presages a downturn in the U.S. stock market, as it indicates that liquidity is being withdrawn. The TED spread fluctuates over time, but historically has often remained within the range of 10 and 50 basis points. The TED spread elliptically hit a boundary of 458 basis points last October, and today is approximately 150 basis points. The commercial paper market, a critical provider of short-term capital to corporate America, has also shown some recent life. Issuers and investors have moved to longer durations, conveying greater acceptance of risk. As earlier noted, Plutarch stated the need to learn from our mistakes in order to repeat future problems. The New Deal adopted the following corrective economic and fiscal measures to resolve the Great Depression. First New Deal of 1933 focused on restoring confidence to our financial sector. The second New Deal between 1935 and 36 focused on creating jobs. Today, I suggest we need the third New Deal of 2008. Establish a greater regulatory structure to develop the financial assurance necessary to provide support to our economy and financial markets, to restore the credibility of corporate America and the restoration of confidence by our citizens. In November 2008, I addressed a televised audience for the University of California regarding the financial and economic crisis of 2008. I emphasized that the following areas require critical focus: on the economy, jobs, and infrastructure by both the public and private sector. Financial sector, uncertainty abounds among the retail sector through credit cards. The Federal Reserve, through the management of the 12 banks in 12 districts, need to be ever more vigilant of that. Secondary market of securitized mortgages. Treasury needs to be on top of that. Credit derivatives market, the Treasury and the SEC. The real estate market, housing inventory, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac ever more so need to be on top of that. Residential foreclosures, similarly by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and commercial real estate, the Federal Reserve, through their management of banks in the 12 districts. In the investment markets, we need to be focused on the transparency of investment process and assets, and that's the responsibility of the SEC. Corporate America, we need greater corporate governance. That's also the mandate of the SEC. Globally, I suggest, advocate, the coordination and regulation of global capital markets, and that's within the boundary of the Treasury. Restore economic confidence. That's the responsibility of each and every one of you. Although the Obama presidential administration has been attentive to many of the above critical focal issues, solutions for remediation of this economic crisis remain undefined. I suggest a 10-point plan. Today, our corporate structure, the tax on corporations, is among the highest in the world. I suggest and implore government to realize a suspension of capital gains for a period of time. We need to encourage the public and private investment programs. We need to encourage investment from the private sector, which today is roughly between $2 and $3 trillion. We need to apply additional tax stimuli, namely tax credits, to support next generation industries. In the financial sector, we need to create an Uber financial regulatory agency. Fragmentation of the regulatory sector creates inefficiencies and heightens probability for misdeeds. We need to establish greater capital reserve requirements for securitized loans. We need to increase diligence and concern. And most of all, the banks need to have some skin in this game. in the real estate sector, we need to include jumbo mortgage loans in modified real estate lending guidelines. Subprime is a small percentage as compared to jumbo mortgages, a majority of which are set to reset in May of 2010. In the investment markets, I suggest a reinstatement of the uptick trading rule. We need to limit downside pressure in these times on the investment markets and restore confidence. In corporate America, I've suggested this for quite some time. We need to mandate professional boards of directors. Globally, we need to support the establishment of a new international agency to better regulate global capital markets. Today's financial markets are global. And most of all, we need to forego protectionistic trade policies. We live in a global society of which we account for 40% of global trade. We need our global trading partners as they need us to resolve today's global economic problems. The Great Depression was forestalled by the protectionistic measures legislated in the Smoot-Hawley Act of 1930, which prolonged the Great Depression by a decade. And above all, we need to restore economic confidence, and that's, once again, the responsibility of each and every one of you. The above summation is an attempt to explain the cause, impact, and considerations for the remediation of our current economic crisis. Yet many remain an enigma regarding the duration of this period of economic financial duress. As such, the dynamic nature of this economic crisis of 2008 and beyond make it difficult to discuss its duration, which is left to those who have the responsibility and ability to execute measures to resolve this crisis. In concluding, I'd like to refer to a quote by and from Ronald Reagan, our esteemed president, who eloquently stated, "This is not the time for political fun and games. This is a time for a new beginning. Time is of the essence. It is up to each of us as individuals to guide our new dawn," or as Prime Minister Winston Churchill once stated, "Destiny is not a matter of chance. It is a matter of choice. It is not a thing to be waited for. It is a thing to be achieved." It is the responsibility of each of us as concerned citizens to remain optimistic and collaborate on determining the successful fulfillment and destiny of our great nation. To that, I say yes, we will. Thank you.
I want to thank Patrick Yam, our speaker this evening, for talking to us in a really comprehensive way about what's been going on over the last year or so, and I thank you very, very much for that. It all seems, in a way, and now we move into the Q&A period, and if you do have a question, please ready that and raise your hand, and I guess I'll start out. In a way, it all seems so complicated in the sense that this very complex living system that we humans are part of globally and everything. And I'd like you to respond to the question that says, and I'm obviously oversimplifying by saying, what if a bubble is all about just letting the air out and letting all the individual actors make adjustments? That is, all the individuals as individuals and the organizations, both for-profit, non-profit, and everything, they just make adjustment. We've all kind of downsized our purchase habits to some degrees, et cetera. So my question relates to taking that simplistic approach of just letting all the individual quote-unquote actors make adjustments versus trying to intercede with either new or better regulations or controls. Where is that sweet spot in between just letting it happen and then going through, as you did so comprehensively there, some of these regulatory things that need to be addressed?
San Francisco. Otherwise, if I had that answer, it'd be in D.C.
But you have some thoughts on it, I'm sure. And if you would please, maybe I can get you another microphone, because we want to make sure we get your recordings.
Thank you.
So I'm sure you have some thoughts on that. The simplistic versus trying not to overcomplicate.
Well, most certainly, you know, I'm a fond advocate of Adam Smith and the principles of free markets. I think the thing is that yet in a period as such, as I so prefaced, we're fighting an 8-alarm fire today. Okay? One best. We've only been trained for 4. You know, the thing is that in periods like this, it's not a matter of understanding which fires to put out first. It's a matter of putting out all fires. We do not have the luxury of time. And the thing is that what is simplistic or what is difficult, that's really, you know, going to be something that's really extremely subjective to best determine when the element of time is ever so effusive.
Other questions from the audience?
Hi, Patrick.
Yes, Steve.
My question is that given how consumer demand was the fuel of our economy so much so prior to this downturn, and now consumer demand, which is in great part fueled by people pulling money out of their mortgages and extremely easy usury laws, which are going to be going away, and credit will not be as available, which is probably appropriate, what happens to consumer demand? And, you know, look at the car companies. That's why people aren't buying cars, in part. Thank you.
Well, most certainly, there'll always be a level of consumer demand. I think the thing is that most certainly the dynamics and the dimensions of consumer demand tomorrow will be far differently than it has been yesterday. Yesterday, it was exacerbated by the leniency, okay, of leverage. It's not a matter of how many of you have received credit card applications in your mail slots, okay? And yet, the thing is that going forward, it's not going to be that lenient. I think the thing is that most certainly we live in a period of time where we are recognized as being the consumptive society, okay? I think the thing is that the greater a regulation of a financial market on a global perspective is most certainly necessary. And hopefully that, you know, gets to a point where consumers and consumptive societies are just beyond the shores of our shore. Okay? And I think that's happening, quite frankly.
Yes. If you read The Economist recently or the Financial Times, European banks are broke, and so are ours. What is your comment on that?
Well, I'll be better able to address that on Thursday. I think the thing is that most certainly the stress tests, that's a no-brainer, okay? It's an absolutely a no-brainer. The thing is that we know how broken the banks are. And today, I gave a speech during lunch today talking about the stratification of our financial industry, from those banks that are banks and those banks that aren't banks. I think the thing is that the necessity for banks, as reported this morning in the Wall Street Journal, as Citi, Bank of America, to go to the financial markets today, it's a very precarious position to be in, okay? I think the thing is at the end of the day, I'm not an advocate, period, of the financial sector being regulated by the public sector. I think, yet it is a necessity. I think the thing is that this is an 8-alarm fire in which corrective measures need to be applied. But I hope I've answered your question.
Yeah, I'd just like to say this crisis is being portrayed as like something that never happens before. But in fact, financial crises do happen to different countries at different times around the world, and there is a standard IMF procedure for dealing with a crisis, which would involve allowing certain banks to fail, and banks that are in too much of a bad shape to be nationalized and have their balance sheets cleaned up and then refloated back out to the market. I wonder what your view is of why the standard IMF procedure, which is pretty regularly applied to other countries, is not being applied to the U.S. itself.
You know, that's a great question. It's a question that I ponder and wonder about at all times. I think the thing is it the IMF? Is it the Bank of International Settlement? Or is it the fact that we really need a new financial institution on at the global scale, you know, supported, mandated by the leading economies to make sure that tomorrow's, you know, financial system works better? Well, certainly. We haven't gotten to the point where, as you so said, that the IMF has allowed for banks to, you know, fail. We need to, okay? And we won't get through this period until such time that we do. You know, to date, we've allowed 40 banks this year to fail, okay? Most certainly, they're smaller banks. Each bank has a different charter. It may not be necessarily the right charter, okay? But the ills and the excesses of a lean and credit society needs to be corrected.
Patrick, you talked about rebuilding confidence as a big part of this whole thing, and all of us, as we hear the talking heads and we read the Financial Times or whatever each day, there are all these boogeymen in the woods out there that people worry about, whether it's, is there going to be a big failure, a bubble bursting in commercial real estate, or will there be one of the big, too big to fail companies that fails, whether it's a GM or Bank of America or AIG, and there are various things like that. Or is there one or two particular risks that you worry about most over the next 6 months that could be a tipping point for good or evil here?
Yeah, I think you and I've chatted about it several times, but my greatest, pardon me for a second. Back in my days at the Federal Reserve back in the early 70s, and it's not dissimilar today, is the fact that our economy is like a car, okay? The engine shuts off for too long of a period of time. It is ever more difficult to resuscitate it. I think the one thing that I'm trying to implore each of you is to better understand and to seek the understanding of what really this crisis is about. Because the thing is it's going to get to a point where, irrespective of what media you gather your information from, it's ever going to be more conflicting. And the one pejorative issue that is of concern to me is that of the fact that pessimism, okay? And pessimism is easy to gain, okay? Optimism is not. I think the thing is that when you read about the fact that that nationally we have a 10% unemployment rate, and most certainly it'll be higher than that. It's 8.6%, soon to be 10%, I should say, okay? You hear about the travails of whether or not Chrysler yesterday, possibly GM tomorrow, some of the banks. You know, once again, it's not easy to gain, you know, to be optimistic. We need to be. So, Chris, in answering your question, what is the one thing? I think the thing is that the one thing is just making sure you best understand this crisis. Look beyond what the Jim Cramers of the world are telling you. There's no deference to Jim Cramer. He does a great job, and he's done a great job. But guess what? Question what Jim Cramer, question what I've said to you. Question what anybody says to you. Remain optimistic, and the odyssey to optimism is really through knowledge.
I want to remind our audience we're listening to Patrick Yam, CEO of Sensei Partners and a faculty member at Leve School in Santa Clara. He's talking to us about the economic crisis. And I guess I would follow on to that last questioner with regard to what worries you have. Would you say you worry about too much government intervention or too less as we go after this 8-alarm fire? Are there concerns about, because we'll only know if we got it right in the rearview mirror. Once we get down the road, we'll be able to then assess it. But too much, too little, where do you see the...
It certainly is an easier job being a Monday morning quarterback than it is playing the game on Sunday. It's a very fine line. It's a fine line where, as I previously stated, Tom, it's a matter of the fact we do not have the luxury of time to best determine whether or not we're making the right moves. And we've got to cover all the moves. We've got to make the fiscal and the monetary and the governmental policies, okay, to cover as much as you can cover. I'm not an advocate for public sector intervention. As I mentioned, I'm an advocate of Adam Smith and free markets, okay? But these are unheralded times.
I wonder if you could comment on the prospects for high inflation. I'm thinking in terms of the increase in money supply and as well the coming entitlements crisis with Medicare and Social Security, and from my generation, bankrupting the company or the country.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you said that, because there was an 11th point on my 10-point plan. And that 11th point was the fact that we need to have a presidential line item veto, okay? Because entitlements today account for roughly 63% of our fiscal budget. It's very difficult, as a former CEO, for me to step into, you know, best understanding how I'm going to guide any enterprise a given next year, when my budget's already been filled by 63% of said, you know. And so the thing is inflation here? Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, if you're in Omaha this past weekend, you know, Mr. Buffett most certainly said that inflation's here. Many others have ascribed to the fact that inflation's here. I say that inflation's right around the corner. The one thing that we've got to be careful about is the fact that inflation by itself, we can manage. A stagnating economy, which lends itself to stagflation, which took place in the 70s when I was at the Fed, is ever more difficult proposition.
Yeah, if confidence is such a huge component of economic activity overall, what would you say to the retail investor, let's say, who, you know, more and more are starting to feel as though they've been sold a bill of goods with respect to stocks for the long run? And then just a greater comment on confidence overall when you think about, at, you know, consumers looking at their own balance sheets, not seeing nearly as much there as was there 2 years ago, then being asked to go out and spend and have confidence, 8-alarm fire versus being trained for a 4-alarm, you know, is, with respect to a decline in confidence, is that already in the fire? Or, you know, what can be done to repair that?
And perhaps the thing that I've been saying is that confidence is dynamic. You can gain it, you can build it just as easily as you can lose it. Yeah. I think the thing is that we're at a point where confidence is so precarious. I think in times of precariousness, I think it's best exemplified by the fact that you've seen recently our savings rates increase, you know, tremendously. And so the correlative to that is the fact that consumptive behavior really has decreased considerably. The thing is that there is a point between excess of consumption and the fact of mainstay consumption, okay, or consumption by itself. I think the thing is that we're going to get back to a point where historically, in such periods, people will inevitably lose optimism. Pessimism will gain, and that's ever more to fight. That's why I'm encouraging each and every one of you. You've got to go on out there. You've got to figure out what's going on. You've got to best determine the fact you want to be optimistic, okay? There's a price level in answering your question in which a new General Motors car is going to make sense to you. I don't know what that is, but you know what? Don't be stricken by fear in itself.
Patrick, I want to talk to you, have you talk a little bit about inflation. We touched on it a couple questions back. The slide that caught my eye was almost $3 trillion pumped in the economy. So at this moment, we have too many dollars chasing too few goods. That's our definition of inflation. At the same time, William Seedman, you know, a distinguished former FDIC chairman, said the other day on CNBC, he thinks it might be different this time around. What do you see in terms of timing for inflation? It seems like you do see inflation. What do you see in terms of timing?
I do see inflation. And I think the thing is it, there is, in a nutshell, I don't see inflation really picking up until mid-year of next year in any, you know, defined, in an excessive defined manner. I think the thing is that we are in a period of deflation today, where we will transcend this period of deflationary pressure on assets. And still, we've got a way to go before that. But it is right around the corner.
Patrick, we've come to that point, unfortunately, and I know there are other questions, and I'm sure that people would enjoy continuing to talk about this, and want to thank you very much for your insightful remarks tonight. I'd like to leave you a couple of minutes to highlight and recap of some of the things you'd like us to leave with tonight. You've emphasized us going out there and kind of trying to figure it out and remain optimistic and so forth, but please leave us with some thoughts that you'd like us to go and ponder.
Tom, thanks. You know, as an order, the last thing you want is an opportunity as such to be able to leave a lasting impression on each and every one of you. I think the lasting impression I want to leave with you is the fact that do not become pessimistic. Remain optimistic. The path to optimism is really through knowledge. The odyssey to optimism is really gained from understanding what not to be pessimistic about or what to gain in terms of being optimistic about. Okay. And that's what I'm saying. Thank you.
And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.